United States and this honorable court.
Please be seated. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. We have a relatively large crowd. We had three cases on the calendar, and maybe more than that actually, last week, but through death in the family that others of you know more about than I do, we accommodated, out of respect for the situation, to reschedule. And in fact, for a veteran's case scheduled this afternoon, that was postponed from last week, also because there was a death in the family. That couldn't be rescheduled for today, and we wanted to give you the chance to get out of here before you get iced in. So I hope no one really objects to the unexpected hearing this afternoon. In any event, we have two related cases. Takeda Chemical versus Alpha Farm, 06-1329, Mr. Murphy. And let me say, the court's closed now, and we are grateful to have staff helping us out, and loyal, devoted law clerks, so please proceed.
May it please the court, good afternoon, your honors. The district court made many errors within the scope of its opinion, but I'd like to focus my commentary today within the argument on three of the most serious of those errors. The district court's error with respect to the scope and content of the prior art by carving out from the prior art a Takeda patent prosecution history where Takeda made very damaging admissions to its position as with respect to the predictability that flows out of the 6-methyl and the motivation that flows out of the 6-methyl closest prior art compound. Number two, the district court's decision to allow the patentee to buttress its case of unexpected results by allowing post-patent filing evidence and preventing the challenger, Alpha Farm, from rebutting the case of unexpected results because it was post-filing. We view that as an abuse of discretion. And finally, I'd like to bring your honor's attention to your honor's attention the errors of law with respect to the analysis of obviousness, requiring of Alpha Farm evidence of absolute predictability in an unpredictable art, and the claim that there are no reasonable expectations that any medicinal chemist can have, but they would sit and be paralyzed rather than undertake a research program, particularly one with the clear motivation shown in this art. First, the scope and content of the prior art.
Could I understand what you're arguing? As I understand it, we have claims 1, 2, and 5 here. And if I understand correctly, claim 2 is to the 5-ethyl, but that claims 1 and 5 would also cover the 6-ethyl, correct?
That's right. That's exactly right.
Are you making a separate argument that claims 1 and 5 are obvious, let's say, over the earlier 200 patent?
No. Everything is obvious over the 6-methyl compound. And the 6-methyl compound was disclosed in the 200, not particularly claimed in the 200. There are many millions of compounds. What we're essentially saying is that Takeda claimed a compound as a selection invention from the 779 patent that was earlier disclosed and explained in SOTA 2.
Well, just so that I can understand, are you then saying that in your view, claims 1, 2, and 5, the obviousness of those claims depends in each instance on the 5-ethyls being obvious?
The position is that claims 1, 2, and 5 are all obvious, and that the 6-ethyl is slightly more obvious than the 5-ethyl.
Well, but that's the problem I'm having, because the 1 and 5 cover the 6-ethyl,
right?
Claim 2 is limited to the 5-ethyl.
That's correct.
So conceivably, we could determine that claims 1 and 5 are invalid, but the 2 isn't.
That's right. That's not the relief we're asking for here. What we're saying is that they're both obvious. Their homologation and ringwalking were well known and well practiced in the prior art, and there's every motivation to do what is being claimed here. That is, taking the 6-ethyl and then moving it to the next available position of the ring to preserve potency, the potency of the 6-methyl while tweaking its side effects.
Weren't the tweaking, I mean, tweaking is, this isn't a valve. Wasn't there a demotivation to stop working from that closest prior art, 6-methyl? I mean, it had toxic effects. It was less desirable than pioglitazone.
Only if you cut off the prior art analysis, Your Honor, at 1982. So what the district court had claimed was that there was a teaching away for all the prior art if you focus on 1982. But the district court defined that, had to carve out of the prior art clear evidence of motivation within the 779 patent and the 779 patent prosecution history. So any demotivation was gone by 1984 when the 779 patent issued. The 779 patent specifically claimed the 6-methyl. The 779 patent taught that the class of substituents to use on the pyridyl ring on the left-hand side of the molecule were methyls, ethyls, etc.
But in the final analysis, didn't pioglitazone have superior properties and unexpectedly superior properties? And wasn't that a finding of the district court?
The district court did find so, but the district court had to strike from evidence and had to claim as irrelevant evidence the evidence that showed that the claim by Takeda of unexpected results over the closest prior art was not so. What Takeda claimed to the examiner, and it may have been true at the time, was that pioglitazone was unexpectedly superior in 3 measures. One was heart rate, one was liver weight, and one was anemia. These were on the basis of preliminary screens, 2-week studies. What Alpha Pharm found out in discovery was that Takeda did more robust studies a little later that said that heart rate and anemia were not actual toxic effects. That these are related, in fact, to the comp.
So you're saying they developed and are selling, and it's one of these highly successful compounds, the wrong compound?
No, not at all. Not at all. Simply put, it's a very conservative position. It doesn't have to be any more than this. That Takeda went forward to the examiner and told the examiner, we have unexpected results here in 3 measures. Then they did more robust testing. They did testing at 4 weeks and 13 weeks and found out that actually it's a pharmacological effect, non-toxic. Heart rate and anemia were non-toxic. So 2/3 of the unexpected results case is basically thrown out. Now you're talking about mere differences of degree, not kind. You're not talking about patentability anymore, and it's based on Takeda's own admissions in its more robust testing. That's what the issues are here, and that's why it was so harmful to strike out those particular tests. It's almost as if it's exactly akin to someone who, a doctor, for example, who sees patients over 2 weeks and he gives them high doses of acetaminophen and they have liver cancer. And he notices that there are tumors that shrink in those particular patients. Now he runs to the patent office because he thinks he has something patented, thinks something patentable. He says, well, we have unexpected results here. Look at this, acetaminophen, it's a new property. It can treat liver cancer. Then he's intrigued and he does longer term studies and he finds out through the course of those studies that no, there are confounding factors and the claims to unexpected results were not true, they're false. So what the district court did was say, no patentee can be subject to a challenge later on from post-patent filing evidence that the results were not unexpected. That's just wrong. It's a matter of law, it's wrong. It's a matter of evidence law, it's wrong. It's a matter of policy, it's wrong. The patentability cuts both ways, and unexpected results cuts both ways. Now, with respect to the district court's finding of obviousness, finding of non-obviousness, the district court took the position, based on Takeda's expert, Dr. Danishevsky, that when you make a change to a particular portion of the left-hand side of this molecule, you have no idea what's going to happen as a medicinal chemist. Absolutely not. So nothing can ever be obvious.
Absolutely none?
Well, any variability on the left-hand side of the molecule will, any varying of the substituent on the left-hand side of the molecule will be unpredictable. So there's no reason that you can have an expectation for any particular result. That's ultimately what he said, and that's ultimately what the district court found. Now that obviously has a great deal of effect in the obviousness law and chemical obviousness. There can be no chemical obviousness if there are no reasonable expectations, if the skilled artisan has to know in advance that a particular modification will have a particular result. So in effect, it's requiring of the challenger to show absolute predictability, to be able to look through a crystal ball and know in advance what's going to happen. When in reality, what medicinal chemists do is they look at lead compounds and they see where the predictability is, and Takeda here made admissions in the 777 patent application, and it made admissions in the 779. It said in the 779 that there's no reason to expect that this compound, the 6-methyl, would serve as a blood glucose lowering, a triglyceride lowering agent with low toxicity. It talked about prediction there. So there, to get that patent to cover its own research program on substituted pyridyls from competition, it alleged predictability on the basis of the 6-methyl. The same can be found in the 777 patent, where they approached the examiner and they told the examiner, look at this data on the 5-ethyl. The 5-ethyl shows a superior toxicity results relative to the 6-methyl. But, and they claim, claims 1 and 5 claim the 3 position, the 4 position, and the 6 position. So they're essentially telling the skilled artisan that they have every reason to predict that the safety profile is going to be better there as well. But their trial position was contrary to that. Their trial position was that anything, any change, is going to have unpredictable consequences. We believe that you should hold them to that position, hold them to the position that they took to secure the 779 and the 777 patents. Now, with respect to the harm, let me focus on now the scope and content of the prior art. The district court made a specific finding as to Takeda prosecution history. That finding was as follows. The file wrapper for the 7, you'll find this on page 78 of the opinion at footnote 59. The file wrapper for the 779 patent was simply not accessible to one of ordinary skill in the art, although it was available to the public. Now I'm paraphrasing. Although it was available to the public in 1984, more than a year, by the way, before the 777 patent was filed for, the file history would have had to be specially obtained at the patent office. So,
well, suppose she's wrong about that. Is it really harmful error?
Certainly it is. Certainly it is. The file history for the 779 patent gave clear evidence of motivation to the skilled person, clear evidence that there was no teaching away in SOTA 2. What SOTA 2 says is that there are problems of brown fat and weight gain associated with this compound. If that's unlikely to be productive of the results sought, then why is Takeda specifically claiming the 6-methyl 2 years later? Why is Takeda specifically telling the examiner to that patent that this compound was especially important? Why is Takeda telling the examiner that you can predict, as long as you use the narrow and well-defined range of constituents, the substituents to use on this left-hand side pyridyl ring? So there are a lot of admissions as to predictability that are inconsistent with the district court's ruling, and there are a lot of admissions as to motivation, and there's real harm here. There can be no finding of teaching away under these circumstances. I see that my time is up. I just want to make sure I've answered your question, Your Honor.
Good day.
Okay.
We'll save the rest of your time, Mr. Murphy.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Conlon. This was pretty close prior art, wasn't it?
Structurally?
Yeah.
Structurally, it was fairly close. But
structurally with a similar activity, right? Hypoglycemic.
It was glycemic. They found that to be the case. But in the truth, however, it's eons away. You know, when you're trying to treat diabetes, toxicity is really, really important. People are going to be taking these medicines every day for the rest of their lives. So toxicity is king here. And the question is, really, is this an unexpected, is this an unobvious invention? This is a wonderful invention. And I think it's shown by many different aspects. And the district court's opinion, really the only question you have is, was there clear error shown in holding that they didn't prove obviousness by clear and convincing evidence? And her holdings show intimate knowledge of the detail. That opinion was written by her. It was not an adoption of counsel's recommendation. She knew, and if you see how she ran the trial.
I don't see her addressing the 6F. I mean, isn't it clear that claims 1 and 5 are invalid? Put aside 2 for the moment, and 1 and 5 may not be the focus, but claims 1 and 5 cover the 6F, don't they?
They do indeed, Your Honor. And the court did rely.
Those claims are invalid if the 6F didn't have unexpected results.
I think that the question is whether they proved it to be invalid. But
my statement's correct, right? That those claims are invalid unless the sixth ethyl has unexpected results, right?
Well, I believe that they haven't been proved. Whether or not, I think your point is well taken, and it's much closer. But the point that the judge
didn't even make a separate finding about the sixth ethyl, did she?
She found at one point that there was no predictability of success of going from the ethyl. From the methyl to the ethyl.
But she doesn't find any unexpected results with respect to the 6-ethyl, does she?
No, she did not find any unexpected results. And, you know, I think these claims don't rise or fall together. I think we're really interested primarily in claim 2. That's the one that covers the compound that's on the market. There's no question about it. But I still
think the appeal does apply to all 3, correct?
Of course. And I don't think that they've proven obviousness even of the 6-methyl. I think there's... You know, we don't know. They say that we took the position that these are only because of closeness, of structural closeness. our inventors were available. They could have asked these questions to them. They had a lot more information in 1985 when they wrote the 777 case than they had when they wrote in 1979 when they wrote the 779 application.
Do you think for the generic claim to be invalid on grounds of obviousness, every species thereof must have unexpectedly beneficial properties over the closest prior art?
I believe that for them to be proven invalid, they have to show there has to be a showing that you would go there and that you would expect success in going there. I think that's missing. Now, having said that, I believe
what Judge Lurie is asking you, I think, is if one of the claim compounds in claims 1 and 5 are obvious.
If that's obvious, then the claim is invalid.
Then the claim's invalid.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Of course, a generic claim can have thousands, millions of compounds in it, and it's absurd to think that all of them have to be shown to be non-obvious.
That's true.
But here you have, what, 4 compounds?
4 compounds.
Four compounds.
And why did the inventors believe that they were all patently distinct over the prior art? You know, if you look at what they did, they could have tried to claim much broader. There was some pretty unexpected results about the 5-methyl as well, but they were distinct. They only made a claim to the ethyl compound. They believed that the ethyls were different. We don't know why. They weren't asked.
So you're saying if the generic claim is held to be invalid because the 6-ethyl has not been shown to be unexpectedly superior to the prior art 5-methyl, that's irrelevant to the validity of the species claim.
Absolutely.
5-ethyl.
That's absolutely, that's the law. Each claim is presumed to be independently valid, and claim 2 is independently valid beyond question over claim 6.
But we have a determination here by the district court that claims 1 and 5 are infringed. That's a declaratory judgment. So if claims 1 and 5, in fact, are invalid as obvious, the judgment is incorrect, right?
Well, I think the court...
Is that true?
I think that would be true, yes. Hmm. Yes. But I think the court did not hold the claims invalid, and the reason is simply that the burden was on them to prove they were invalid.
I don't see that she really addressed the validity of claims 1 and 5 in the terms that we've been talking about them here.
She did not specifically rule on whether they're shown unexpected results or anything like that, but she did hold that there was no prima facie case of obviousness. And that being the case, I think the claims are sustainable, but again, I think we're primarily focusing on claim 2, which is the claim of importance in the case. So I think, you know, to get an impression, Mr. Murphy talked about One approach that he has taken is to say that the court precluded them from relying on a later evidence as to whether there was obviousness or unobviousness. I think if you look at the portions of the record cited in our brief, all she did was rule on the admissibility of two documents that were not shown to be admissible. She really didn't take that position. And he said it may have been true at the time that this was unexpected, but in 1992 or 1999 it might have been expected. I think by saying that it may have been true at the time that it was unexpected, he said it's a valid patent because the obviousness is tested as of the time of the invention under Section 103. This is an incredible invention. I would like to show you one document that is from A4692. Takeda, as the judge pointed out, tested thousands of compounds. And then in 1984, they chose the 50 best compounds to be tested because Takeda and Upjohn were working on trying to determine where can we go forward, what kind of a species, what kind of a compound can we go forward with. And of the thousands of compounds, they chose the best 50.
That's what you're showing us?
That's correct, Your Honor. And of the best 50, the only thing I would say is, you know, Dr. Fujita, who was at this meeting, and Dr. Morton, who was at the meeting, they testified in this case. And their testimony is particularly telling. Dr. Morton and Dr. Polka from Upjohn came as volunteers and sat for a couple of weeks waiting to testify on their own dime with no connection to Decatur or anything else. They tell you what it was like in 1984 and what they were considering at that time. And this was incredibly important to them, and it was surprising to them. It was something that you cannot say this is not unexpected results. So, in terms of whether or not the...
What's the evidence of unexpected results for the 6-ethyl?
The 6-ethyl, there is no direct evidence of unexpected results.
And the 6-ethyl is covered by the 200 patent, right?
The 200 patent covers generically the 6-ethyl as well. Yes, that's right, Your Honor. That's correct. It does, along with about another million compounds that are generically covered.
Is it disclosed?
6-ethyl is not disclosed, specifically disclosed, no. It's only generically within the scope of the claim. So, in this case, there is the other point that he tried to make was that we should be saddled to our position in the 779 patent and saddled to our position in the 777 patent with regard to generic coverage. I'd just like to make a couple of comments on that. In the 779 patent, if you look at what the attorney actually said, all he said was that there's no reason to doubt that these would be functional. There was a 112 enablement requirement rejection, and that's all you really need to expect. In the 779 patent, no question was raised and no statement was made by us, so there's no reason to tie to Takeda any statements as to the scope of the claims. And in fact, if you looked at the evidence, it's actually in the 779. Compare the methyl groups that are disclosed in there, three of which are not even in the prior art. We disclose them for the interest of the examiner. That shows that there are significant differences between adjacent homologs and methyls and ethyl groups. So I think that we cannot be tied to any admission or any position in that case. The other point is that there is tremendous evidence of non-obviousness in this case. This drug has brought hope and the quality of life to millions of people. It's the seventh fastest drug in the history of mankind and made $1 billion a year in sales. So this thing is really, if there were even assuming that there were some evidence of obviousness or that the court was wrong, that they did show that there was prima facie obviousness, that still would be way overweighed by the evidence of unexpected results and commercial success, long felt but unsolved need, and other evidence of non-obviousness that the court pointed out.
Could you comment on the file record of the 779?
Yes, I would. The court did have that footnote, which is a little bit confusing. She says at the beginning that it wasn't available, but she talks about it being available. But the court did not rule it was not prior art. In fact, she went on and considered it. Under the cases, what she has to do is look at the prior art as a whole. And we sent a copy of the In Re Lilly case from December this year to the court a week or so ago. It's clear that you have to look at the prior art as a whole, and that's what she did look at.
But she made a mistake, did she not, by dismissing the prosecution history of the 779 patent, right?
She didn't dismiss it, Your Honor. She did talk about it, and she said she considered it along with the teachings of the Soda II article, and she considered it in many places. If you look
I thought
at
she
AA,
said that someone skilled in the art wouldn't have looked at it, wouldn't have paid any attention to it.
She said that looking at the art of a whole, as a whole, they would be more led by the Soda II article. And that was the evidence, that was the testimony that was before her.
Well, she
testimony.
Said it was not accessible to one of ordinary skill in the art, I think, in the footnote.
That's correct.
Which certainly suggests that, in effect, it wasn't prior art. I mean, if you say it wasn't accessible, you're really saying it isn't something that's going to be considered as prior art in making the determination of whether that person, a hypothetical person of skill in the art, had material before him or her that would render it obvious.
That's correct. And if that was an error, and it was a harmless error, because she went on and considered it as prior art despite mm-hmm. that. If you look at page 880, she points out that one skilled in the art would not have relied on the 779 reference to identify the compound B, given the more exhaustive and reliable scientific analysis presented by Soda II. If you look at A89 of the opinion, she says, in any event, nothing in the 200 and 779 patents or in any other publication from Takeda would have given an expectation of success in changing from the methyl to the ethyl. She did, in many cases throughout her opinion, go ahead and treat the 779 and treat it as part of the prior art as a whole, which is what she's required to do under the court's flexible standard of determining obviousness. So I think the other point that was argued in the brief is the question of whether or not it was a prima facie case. And here, the prima facie case never was made by the evidence. Once the evidence of unexpected results, once rebuttal testimony is given, the court quite correctly said, we have to begin all over again. We have to start afresh. That's the law of this court. And so doing that, she looked to see whether or not the evidence that they submitted at trial amounted to a prima facie case of obviousness. She found that they failed in the proof to do that. Her findings are well supported by very substantial evidence in the record. And I believe that that is a good, solid basis on which this court should affirm the district court's opinion. This is really a classic case of a wonderful invention. It's the kind of invention that the patent system is designed to protect. And I think that the district court's decision is very meticulous in its detail, very detailed. It's 120 pages long. It's hard to find anything that wouldn't have a minor mistake in it. But there's no harmful error that's been shown in this record. And the decision of the district court should be affirmed.
I go back, if I could, just for a moment to the...
Yes,
I know neither party regards claims 1 and 5 as the core issue in this case, but nonetheless we have to deal with all of the claims that are in play. Is there any... If we were to invalidate claims 1 and 5, hypothetically, would it have any practical impact on the parties or on the subject of this litigation?
No, Your Honor. In fact, you'll see at one point in the trial, Mr. Murphy was arguing about claim 1 and the 6-ethyl, and the judge said, well, what difference does that make? What does that get you? And Mr. Murphy in candor had to say, well, not much, Your Honor.
But wouldn't it make a difference on attorney's fees?
I don't believe it would.
Didn't the judge find that the position of the defendants was frivolous?
Yes, I think, but, and the reason, but the
so
overall
reason... So
claims
1 and 5 are invalid, the claims weren't frivolous, were they?
I don't think that they've been shown to be valid. I think the
Well,
case,
but the hypothetical is that we assume that they are found to be invalid, and the question then is, does it have any effect? And the question more precisely, as Judge Dyke correctly says, how about attorney's fees?
I don't believe it should affect attorney's fees.
Would the prevailing party be the same?
Pardon me?
Would the prevailing party be the same?
Prevailing party would still be the same, and the question is whether they went ahead.
Well, you wouldn't be the prevailing party on claims 1 and 5, would you?
You certainly would be able to.
If we found that they were invalid as obvious, you wouldn't be the prevailing party on claims 1 and 5.
I think the patent would be valid and would be infringed, and we would go forward.
Patents aren't valid or invalid. Claims are valid or invalid.
Right. Yes, you're right. You're right. You're quite right. But I believe we still would be the prevailing party. The patents would be remain valid. And I think the issue before the House in that case is different than what is the details of claims 1 and 6. I think the issue as far as the attorney's fees, which is a case for a different day, I think the attorney's fees is whether they acted in good faith in proceeding the way they did.
But what we do here is going to affect the attorney's fees. The attorney's fees judgment was based on her view of this case, wasn't
it? It was.
Thank you, Mr. Conlon.
Thank you, Your Honor. And thank you again for making the arrangements so that we can be heard today. We appreciate that.
Mr. Murphy, if you have a generic claim, does every species within the generic claim have to be non-obvious over the prior art to be valid?
Certainly has to be enabled, and there has to be some predictability with respect to enabling that generic claim. But you certainly can have compounds within a generic claim, particularly really very, very broad generic claims, where you can have non-obvious compounds, certainly. It's not what we have here, of course. What we have here is a 779 patent prosecution history saying that this particular compound, the 6-methyl, is especially important. We have a problem identified in the prior art with taking an unsubstituted pyridyl, getting activity when you stick a substituent out of the 6, and then having some associated side effects, which tells the skilled person to move that substituent up and perhaps lengthen it.
But if we find the 6-methyl is not motivating prior art, then not only would the 5 ethyl compound, pioglitazone, be non-obvious, but so wouldn't the generic claim. Is that right?
I believe if you find the 6-methyl non-motivational, that's correct. That is correct. Certainly all the evidence in the case, however, it's in our view, points to the 6-methyl, including the district court's error in our view that SOTA 2 taught away. It did not. It actually motivated toward the 6-methyl. With respect to the determination of clearly erroneous, the factual findings, the bottom line there is that obviousness is a de novo determination of law, and there are underlying factual findings underneath it. So you can find that the court misapplied the law and as a result reached the conclusion that the district court did. That's Alpha Pharma's view. With respect to commercial success, for example, with respect to long-felt but unmet need, neither of those were shown. We've talked about that in our briefs. Commercial success simply has no validity where there's a prior art dominating patent. That's the 779 patent. No one could get into this market, so there's no way, when I say market, that is on substituted pyridyls. There's simply no way that persons could try and fail within the prior art time frame. Nor was there any long-felt but unmet need, because Rezolin was marketed and then rosiglitazone was marketed and immediately filled the need before Actos came onto the market. Finally, with respect to the 5-ethyl, the 5-ethyl was the next natural, logical step that you take when you have a compound as efficacious as this one, where there are minimal problems that you want to avoid. It's the next available step on the way. And we've shown that. We showed a prima facie case As a result of that, we think that the patent is invalid.
Thank you, Mr. Murphy. We'll take the case under advisement.